Love, Lust, and Laughter with Dr. Diana Wiley and Billy Sage, Fridays at 6 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Aloha and welcome, everybody. Once again, it's time for another scintillating edition of Love, Lust, and Laughter. That's Wiley and Sage, folks, and this is your faithful sidekick on the Honolulu side of the pond, Bill Sage, along with Dr. Diana Wiley up there, sleepless in Seattle and over in New York with PRN. And our special guest today will be Joan Price, the author of Naked at Our Age. Naked at Our Age, huh? The horror. Well, actually, the ecstasy when you think about it. So here she is, the hostess with the mostest in all of her 60 trillion or so cells, as everybody usually has with their mammal with opposable thumbs like you and me, Dr. Diana Wiley.
Thank you, Billy Sage. I am delighted today. We are delighted today to have Joan Price, as Billy said, naked at our age, talking out loud about senior sex. But I want to encourage you right at the top of the show, if you're under, say, 50, stay tuned. There's a lot to learn. And Joan talks about the ick factor, and in a moment I'm going to have her talk a little bit more about it because it often refers to younger people. But let's remember that sex is part of life's celebration, and on her website, there are two of them, joanprice.com and
nakedatourage.com.
There you go.
NAKEDATOURAGE.com.
Yes. And so one of the media buzzes says, wrinkly sex kitten? Yeah, why not? Enter the world of Joan Price, our mighty middle-aged Aphrodite. Very nice, Joan Price. So good to have you with us.
Well, great to be here, Diana.
Well, thank you. And you really do talk out loud, and they're just no holes barred. It's quite wonderful. I think since there's no upper limit to our sexual functioning, usually as long as we're healthy and we have the right attitude, I think it's best to relate to your aging changes, not only, well, maybe for some it's a loss, but it's also an opportunity to explore and express new aspects.
Well, that's how I see it, Diana, that the changes, which we often take as really disconcerting, are an opportunity to explore, to take a new journey, to find out what we love now.
Yes, what we love now. And I tease the audience with the ick factor. Talk about the ick factor.
Yes, the ick factor is the name I gave to this kind of comment. Ew, old people having sex. And I encounter that all the time. And I have to say to them, well, let's see, at what age do you plan to retire your genitals? Is
precisely.
It 50 or maybe 47 and a half? Exactly when will that be?
You know, I heard from one of my clients who went into his doctor with after having had a prostate cancer diagnosis, and his doctor said, because this guy was 56, the doctor said, whoa, well, sex isn't so important anyway after 55, and the guy looked at him and said, well, because the doctor who said that was about 45, and so the guy looked at his doctor and said, well, I hope you'll report to me when you're 55. And
yeah, exactly.
And so sometimes you have to be there.
What's the acronym? AYOOFM.
What
Are
is
you
that?
Out of your freaking mind?
Yes. And what I love about your book, which is the second book, but Naked at Our Age, Talking Out Loud About Senior Sex, is that you give real-life people over 50 a voice to tell their stories of their past and present sex lives and ask questions and get straightforward advice and information from experts. And I'm honored because I'm on 2.5 pages of your book.
And a great 2.5 pages they are, too.
Oh, thank you so much. And you're so generous.
You give great advice.
Well, thank you. You're
here's
so generous.
Here's a half-page leaflet. Positions for people with severe arthritis in their knees.
Okay. God. Anyway, you on your website, you do a little YouTube introduction, which I thought was excellent. I mean, you're welcome. Could you kind of give our listeners, I mean, they can go to your website, and I hope they do, but a little preview of that website, YouTube.
Yes. Well, what I do there is I explain why I have two different senior sex books, Better Than I Ever Expected, Straight Talk About Sex After 60. I wrote when I was in the middle of the most extraordinary love affair with Robert, whom I met when I was 57 and he was 64, and he became my husband after the book came out. But it was to celebrate senior sex because there wasn't anything really out there that did that.
Yeah.
And then after this book came out, people would come up to me or they would email me and they'd say, well, isn't that great that you're having sex that's better than you ever expected? But you know what? I'm not. And here's why. Here's what's going on for me. And they would tell me their story. And I realized, oh, my gosh, I have to, A, find the answers for these problems, and, B, I have to write a new book that addresses that other side of sex after 50 or 60, the side that says it's not the way it used to be and I don't know what to do to make it better. And I found that the answers were out there, that they were not really hidden mysteries, except that the people who knew them, the therapists and the doctors and the researchers, were too busy doing their work to disseminate the information. So that's why I wrote Naked at Our Age, to bring together the real people with their stories and their questions with the experts who had the answers for them. And I'm so excited about the reception this book is getting.
And you told me earlier that because this book is getting such good reception, that Better Than I Ever Expected, your first book, is now selling again.
Yes, I know. I think that's wonderful.
And they really are companions.
People often buy them together because they really are a pair.
Yes,
there's
they're a pair.
There's a celebration of senior sex, and then there's the what to do about the problems. And I'm so happy people are discovering the first one again and relating so well to the second one.
Now, your late husband, Robert Rice, says a very wise thing toward the end of your book. He sexuality as I have experienced it. So we have some of his thoughts. And I especially liked his last point. We elders who have lived a long sexually active life are among the best resources on sexuality for younger people because what we have to teach is tempered by wisdom more than libido. Hear, hear to dear sweet Robert, who died, when did he die, in 2009?
He died in 2008, almost 3 years ago.
Okay. And what we have in common on this radio program today is that the three voices you're hearing we've all had losses. Joan lost her husband, Robert. I lost my husband, Charlie, to death. And although it was earlier, it was quite a few years ago, but still very vivid, of course. And Bill Sage lost his wife, Jan. How long ago was it, to cancer?
It's been March 12th.
March 12th. And so we all have that in common. So I thought, with you, Joan, taking the lead because you're our guest, if you'd talk a little bit about Robert and how he inspired the first book and how you're really honoring him in your second book, and about your love affair and your grief pattern process.
Sure. Well, when Robert and I first became a couple, we were astounded at just how sexy and passionate and emotionally charged we were over this wonderful new love affair. And was it like a love affair in the 20s and 30s? No, it wasn't like that at all. And yet in some ways, in many ways, it was better because we had the experience of decades of relationships, of having already made our mistakes, of having learned how to dialogue about sex and about life, having learned what we want, not just sexually, but also sexually, but also from a relationship, from life, from work, from goals going forward. And it felt like we brought so much to our relationship that we couldn't have had we been 30 or 25 years old. And it was just so amazingly wonderful that I couldn't believe that people were so quiet about senior sex. I couldn't believe there were no books out there that already celebrated this, and so that's why I wrote one. And Robert, being an artist, was a very shy person.
Mm-hmm.
And he thoroughly believed in what I was doing. But mm-hmm. he even said, and I haven't shared this with you before, Diana, that when I was writing Better Than I Ever Expected, and I would mm-hmm. bring portions of a chapter to read to him to make sure that he was okay with these intimate details I was
mm-hmm.
sharing.
Mm-hmm. Which was considerate.
Yeah, well, I thought that was the least I could do. And he'd go, oh, you sure you need to put that in? And I'd say, yeah, I really do. And he'd say, well, don't use my name. Call me Fred. And then I'd say, but wait, the people who don't know you wouldn't care, and the people who do know you would then think I was having an affair with Fred. what's the point of that? And he was just very shy and private. But yeah. then after the book came out and it got a 95% absolutely enthusiastic reception,
mm-hmm.
but there was a 5% of the ick factor.
Mm-hmm.
And when he saw that ick factor in action, he said, oh, my God, I never realized how important this work is.
Yes.
You've got to keep doing it.
Yes.
And then once we knew that he had cancer, and we went through quite a long time with cancer, but when we realized that we were not going to be able to get him healthy again, he said, promise me that you'll keep doing your work. And at the time, I was so distraught about being on the brink of losing him that it just didn't, I mean, I'd have promised him anything, of course, but I didn't even really register what he was asking me.
Yes.
And then after he died, I went into a profound grief, the deepest sorrow. I was describing it today to someone as drowning in fire. Can you relate to that?
Yes. I remember after Charlie died, and his death was sudden. He died of a heart attack, but young at 57. And one of my friends, a doctor, offered me Prozac, and I said, no, Judy, thank you, though. I really want to go through the whole process of grief. And I remember so well that the process of grief put me in touch with my emotions in deeper ways. And I really felt newly transformed, and my heart became more open.
Mm.
And then I was told that I was touching others authentically, because I had a radio show then, and I had a grief counselor on. I took a month off after his death. But I had a grief counselor on. In fact, it was Bill Sage's sister, Ann Sage.
Mm.
And in helping others, I discovered I helped heal myself. And it is a process. And Joan, you're doing the same thing.
Well, exactly right. And
mm-hmm.
and I have to say, it took me more than a month to get back to.
Well,
being
I'm
able
not saying
to.
I just couldn't be on the radio for a month, but
yeah.
And then getting through, Bill, I think, was listening to those two shows, and
I was.
Yeah, and I, of course, broke down. It was very hard to do them, but the audience was lovely. They said, you know, in general, we don't talk enough about death and dying
right.
and grief.
That's right.
And so it's important.
If I can make a brief...
please, I want you to, Bill, and I want you to talk about Jan, if you're willing.
I'd like to. Someone in my... I'm a recovering alcoholic, and one of my dear friends in the program lost her husband in a plane crash
mm-hmm.
Back in 1998, and she's just now beginning to call herself a widow. She didn't find the just sobriety until 5 years after it, so she buried her grief in an estate.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
in the process of restoring her life, she has found deeper insight and compassion. And she just gave me a book. C.S. Lewis married a woman. He knew she already had cancer.
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
were married briefly, and he wrote a book called A Grief Observed, which he just gave me a couple of days ago, a very short, very poignant collection of essays about what he's going through,
yes.
what he went through. And I realized Jan had breast cancer diagnosed in 2004, but she was symptom-free. And when we married, the cancer had metastasized into stage 4 and was diagnosed, they told us, on Valentine's Day 2009. But we married anyway on September 9th, 2009, which would have been 5 years symptom-free for her from the time of first diagnosis. And she used the Gonzales Protocol, which she heard about in Suzanne Summers' book, Knockout, Interviews with Doctors Who Are Curing Cancer. Conventional medicine at Kaiser said that she would be dead by July of 2009, no matter what, because their prognosis was 6 months. But she lived pain-free and symptom-free using the protocol for almost 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, it wasn't until... She didn't start pain pills until literally about 10 hours before her death.
Wow.
But that very morning, they were having a hospice meeting on the 11th of March because things went bad really fast. It had metastasized into her liver and lungs. But the bilirubin count was reaching the point of fatal toxicity, and they said it might be a matter of days. But one of the dear friend who gave me the book was there, one of the people that we'd relied upon as a good friend, and she was starting to massage Jan's feet.
Mm.
She said, "God, that feels so good. I am so horny." And this,
this
was less than 24
That's a nice compliment, Bill.
That was less than 24 hours before.
Oh, wow.
The last thing she said, "I'm trying to get hungry," that night, literally about an hour before, she slipped into the, just the
A coma?
Coma. It was raving. It's like death by injection with flaming gasoline. Bilirubin toxicity is just agony. It's like being burned at the stake.
Mm-hmm.
But that's when she started IV fentanyl, but before, and it also deranges you.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
well, you know...
That, she said, "I'd like a real kiss."
Oh!
Yes.
Oh,
and,
how wonderful!
And what Joan and I talked about earlier is that we, you know, to be touched and to be sexual in any form is life-affirming.
Yes. Yeah.
And you talked about something just a little bit ago, Bill, that it makes me think that most people have lived their lives hiding from pain, thinking that anything that is attended by pain cannot be good. And so I think that these people forget that all growth occurs at our edge.
Ah, well said, Diana.
Well, you know, it's one of the things that I got in touch with, and like Bill's marriage to Jan, your marriage to Robert, my marriage to Charlie, I felt that our lives together were fused with passion, and it was so transcending and transforming.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And Joan, talk more about how that was for you with Robert and what insights you got and what inspired you to write a little bit more about it in your new book.
Yeah, well, after Robert died, as I said, I went into really deep, deep, profound grief, and I did need to have antidepressants just to function.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
I want to say that for that reason,
mm-hmm.
some of us need that and shouldn't say no to it, and others
exactly.
can say, I'd rather just stay with this edge. And I found that, it's what felt like an elephant kicking me in my chest became just bicycling through peanut butter.
Oh,
I don't know if that's any good
great
as an analogy.
Great metaphor, yeah.
Yeah, that it was tolerable. It was still almost impossible,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't like an elephant kicking the breath out of me all the time. I
mm-hmm.
couldn't function, even though I could never get anywhere. And during the first year, I gave myself permission not to do anything that didn't feel right to me. And I told everyone, I don't know if I can accept any invitations. I'm not going to take any deadlines. I said no to all jobs that were offered me, other than teaching my contemporary line dance class, which was my refuge. It was the place where I'd met Robert. It
mm-hmm.
was a place where everyone knew him,
mm-hmm.
and everyone mourned him. And, in fact, I taught my class 2 days after he died. And I came into class, and I said, "Robert's free to dance with us again."
Oh my goodness, that makes me want to cry.
It makes me cry, too, and everyone did cry. And there was some, the moment of comic relief, and I have to insert that because thank goodness for people who provide this for us, is one woman who had lost her husband years before, walked into the room that night, and she said, "Joan, you look terrible."
Yeah.
And everybody was horrified. They go, "Ugh." And I laughed, and I said, "I'm sure I do." And she said, "But that's all right. You'll look good again."
Oh, yes.
And then some months later, she said, "See, I was right. You look good again."
Well, the thing is that the more wonderful anything is, the more painful the loss.
Yes.
And I haven't really talked that much about Charlie because it's been 11 years.
Mm.
But I had a friend who, a male friend, who was actually a radio guest, too. And Billy, you know Bob Basso.
That's right.
And he said, "Charlie was God's sunshine warrior who made us all better in the moment and all the subsequent moments we shared his laughing vitality." He wrote, "Your husband was a giant because he gave full measure of love and kindness without pause."
Oh,
I thought that
lovely.
Was beautiful.
Yeah.
Yes. So I think, you know, the three of us all feel transformed in many ways. And I really believe to live in the hearts we leave is not to die.
Yes. Yes. I absolutely agree with that. In fact, I felt that way before Robert died. I thought that's immortality, is that we live on in the people we've touched.
In the people we've touched. And Joan, how many people you are touching now through your books.
Well, that's why I feel I honor Robert with my work. Because when I was at the deepest part of grief, I could not work on the book. I had started it before Robert died, and I couldn't do a thing except keep the blog going and answer emails occasionally when people sent me their stories. I was still collecting interviews, but I couldn't really do any writing. And on the anniversary, on what would have been our wedding anniversary, I was walking around crying, and I felt Robert come to me and say to me, "I don't want to be the reason that you're not living your life."
Yes.
And I was so moved by that.
And
I thought, I'm
he was now reaching you from the other side.
I think he was.
Mm-hmm.
If I may, there was also something that happened in Albuquerque. We had a two-part memorial service. Ashes we scattered off the North Shore, one of her favorite places, but she had a lot of friends and her mother and one of her surviving sisters in Albuquerque. But she had a dear friend who had bottom land by the Rio Grande in old Albuquerque. Under cottonwood trees, we made the final resting place for the other Koa urn. And the night before, she had a dear friend named Sally Blakemore from Santa Fe, where she'd lived for almost 30 years. And Sally has a marimba band with four people. And the night before she came down from Santa Fe, a wild screech owl flew into her bedroom and stayed there all night. Now, the next day, the screech owl hopped up on her shoulder and then sat on her arm until she got in the car and drove to Albuquerque for Jan's memorial service. So she had her husband take a picture of it, and he emailed a copy to Jan's sister, Connie, who is computer savvy compared to her mom. And I was staying at Jan's mom's house in Albuquerque, and she showed me that, and she was starting to tear up and said, "Jan is here." I looked at the owl, and I said, "Wow." And then she said, "Come with me." And around the corner in her bedroom, she had a little curio cabinet, and in it she had over 30 owl figurines.
Oh.
And that was Jan's favorite animal, bird, too.
Ah.
So, is that right?
Pretty much. And so I think she was there to come back like that. That little owl, so I have a picture of it. And the person where she's laid to rest, his significant other is a sculptor who works in both clay and metal, and she's making a bronze statue of the owl life-size to put on the grave.
That's a beautiful
perfect.
Story. Beautiful story. Now, in 5 minutes, we have to go to a break, but I wanted to tell the audience that we're not going to just talk about the grieving process when a precious loved one dies. We are going to go on and talk about Joan's book. She has a chapter on reviving desire, and that's pretty important.
And by the way, folks, if you're listening and you're old enough, most people who are listening and are of a certain age are, as we somebody once said to me, hey, I'm too old to be coy. So if you've got any questions for Joan or for Dr. Wiley, our number is toll-free, 1-888-874-4888. Once again, that's 1-888-874-4888.
And really, thank you, Bill. The single most important thing that we can do in regard to aging and sexuality is to talk.
Yes.
And we're talking about it today. But people need to also talk about it to a physician, to your partner, and to yourself. And it's really, really important. And we're going to talk as we go along about the best way to keep your sexual response system in good shape, like any other body system, is to exercise it and pay attention to it. Right, Joan?
Right.
And so we're going to talk about that. And reviving desire, and then we'll also talk about DWO, what does that mean, Joan?
Dating while older.
Yes. You've got lots of suggestions for internet dating tips and so on for people
that
over.
That does not stand for doing without orgasm.
No, it does not.
Oh, not at all. No. Without
no.
No, and then if we have time, we're going to talk about one of her later chapters, Better Now Than Ever, The Joys of Older Age Sex. Now, Joan, fortunately, is returning on July 22nd, so that'll be part two, and we'll be able to talk about that in case time doesn't allow all of these very important segments so that we can get the word out. Joan, could you, right up till the break, could you talk about how some of the responses you've had, just in general, to your books?
Well, at the risk of bragging,
I want you to brag.
The most valuable one is a woman who said, I've read three chapters and you've changed my life.
Oh, wow. See? Wow.
Yeah. I put my hand on my heart when I heard that, and it just was going flutter, 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 because that's, of course, what I want to do. I want to give people the information they need. And I've had a lot of response from men who have said, thank you. I never knew this about other men. I didn't know how women felt about ED, for example. I didn't know how to communicate my changing needs. And it's just wonderful that men are taking the time to talk to me about that, because a lot of folks think, well, women are the ones that buy books and read books, that we don't really need to put information out for men. And, of course, that's so false.
It's so false. And your blog, which people can find on Better Than I Expected, blogspot?
Well, the easiest place is nakedatourage.com.
Okay, right.
Now, that's a shortcut to it.
Shortcut. So people can go there, and you do get a lot of men contributing on your blog spot, and this is a great place to exchange information. And yes, you're right. We think that it's only women. I mean, some of us think, some of us don't, because I know better. But that only women buy self-help books. But you've got an older man with lots of questions, and he needs good information. And boy, can he ever get it in your two books?
Thank you. And so can women. You know, I don't want to say
it. And so can women.
Yeah, there's so much information for women on every single situation that arises.
Yeah, it's just, they're fabulous books you've written, Joan. We're going to go to our break now, and I want you to stay with us, because when we come back, we're going to talk about reviving desire.
Telefone, Rai. Probabilmente a metro schiavo d'amore.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
The a shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hello, this is Eric Ofner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Why should you be listening to the Progressive Radio Network? Here are a few hosts that call PRN home. Award-winning investigative journalist and documentary filmmaker Michael Ruppert. Acclaimed theoretical physicist Michio Kaku. Notable media critic and international journalist, the news dissector, Danny Schechter. Leading progressive journalists such as Stephen Ledman, John Rappaport, and Glenn Ford have also found a home with us. We also have advice from Richard Martin on how to protect yourself from the ongoing financial collapse. John Mueller tells us his firsthand account on moving out of the U.S. and making a new life for himself in another country on his show, The Expat Files. Along with all these informative programs, we also have health shows hosted by America's top doctors like Mayor Eisenstein, Cheryl Selman, and, of course, Gary Null. The Progressive Radio Network is the place for news and information. This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
We are back with Wiley and Sage, Love, Lust, and Laughter on PRN. Our host today is going to be talking tremendously about things which make us feel wonderfully. If we are older, well, it's a relative term. What do you mean older? I mean, Joan Price, we're not older. We're just, in terms of geologic time, we're all just nanoseconds away from a birth, right?
Older, okay. We're just not old.
Ah,
there you go.
We've all been around since the Big Bang in one form or another. Yeah, old schmold.
Or at least our own last Big Bang.
So I'm going to, at the risk of sounding arrogant, I don't think it is, though, I'm going to quote myself in your book, Joan.
Please do.
And it's advice from an expert, and Diana Wiley, Ph.D. Women, how to get going when you don't feel the urge. And I'm just going to read the first two sentences, quoting myself. Mismatched sexual desire is the number one problem discussed in sex therapist offices. Usually it is the woman with a lower desire. Conflicts develop when lovers have significantly different sexual appetites. And I want to say that I treat low desire as a messenger rather than as a disease. I mean, some people think it's a disease, and it really isn't. And we need to realize that there's short-sightedness when we automatically throw pills or maybe testosterone at whatever ails the woman. Sometimes it's the man with low desire, but it's usually the woman. And as Laura Berman says, no pill will help a woman if she hates her husband. So a lot of times I have to do psychotherapy and relationship therapy and communication therapy and all of that before we can get to sex therapy.
Yes.
And but you've got a very good chapter on reviving desire. And you're welcome.
Well, it's partly because of people like you.
Oh,
because you're the ones that work in the trenches with the people who, the clients, and you see how the strategies that you have honed actually do work and make differences in people's lives. So I just got to have the benefit of all of your hard work when you said, here, this is what works for my clients. And one of the most important things in the whole book, I think, is something that you said in your tips, which is that we tend to think, especially as women, that desire has to come first and then the physical arousal has a chance to work. But in at our age, it's actually the other way around.
Yes, it is.
And I think it's because with our receding hormones, we don't have the biological urge to reproduce, and therefore that huge drive that is saying, yes, now, please, do it to me. We don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
So what, but does that mean we don't have great sex? It doesn't mean that at all. That maybe what we can do is to relax into a bonding with our partner and do the things that we like to do, the kind of physical exchange, the touching, the kissing, the sweetness between partners, and let that lead to the physiological arousal first, and then the emotional desire kicks in. And you were so wise to send that to me, and other experts did also, so I know that it's something that sex therapists know, but most people don't know that.
Yes, so that let's just reiterate that for an older person, oftentimes desire does not precede arousal, that you actually have to start, just do it. Start with the arousal, the foreplay, the touching, the whole body touching, and then desire may kick in. I also talked about it, keeping it playful and incorporating fantasy, and because Bill does such good voices, I told him I was going to talk about how Rodney Dangerfield once, and I'm saying this in your book too, once described a time when he and his wife were, they were trying to make love, but nothing was happening. And what did he say, Bill? Do you remember?
They were trying to fantasize, and he said he was trying to think, and just finally said, oh, what, you can't think of anybody else either?
Well, see, that's right. And of course, keeping it playful, keeping it humorous really, really helps, too. And I tried to be somewhat humorous. I don't know how humorous it was, but I write in your book, that's published in your book, if you've been Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm for 20 years, you probably won't want to jump out of the closet wrapped in saran wrap with a vibrator in each hand.
Besides, the saran wrap isn't really good for us.
No, it isn't. Push down saggy breasts for one thing.
Yeah.
But the point is, change your pattern, change your place, change your approach, change your response, change your style.
And
style, be open.
Change your expectations.
Yeah.
Because we tend to think that we're really supposed to respond like we always did when we were young and hormone-driven.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if we just let go of that and we say, no, let's see, how do I respond now? Which in many cases should be an exploration of how you would pleasure yourself rather than expecting a spouse to figure it out when you don't even know. Figure it out yourself first and then teach your spouse.
Well, that's so important, and it's also so important to masturbate, and you talk about this in your book, to keep yourself juicy, not only when you're with a partner, to know your body and your changing body's needs, but when you're without a partner.
Yes.
And in your book, my friend Candida Royale talks about, since she doesn't have a sexual partner right now, she makes time for herself at least once a week to put one of those natural contour, the energy, it's just weighted, to put that in her vagina and to contract on that. And that helps, just as weightlifting helps with our muscles, that helps with the PC muscles inside the vagina.
Hey, here's an idea. We could open a Jewish sex shop called Kegel's Bagels.
Oh, that's so cute, Bill.
Kegel's and bagels. There you go.
It's got cream cheese on it.
And you could add a dating service, so it'd be Kegel's Bagels and Mensch's.
Oh, very good, John.
Mensch and Mensch at Kegel's Bagels,
We've got something going here.
Oh, I really think there's a place for that.
You know, so
I
often.
I want to join right now.
Okay, good. So often, over the 28 years I've been in practice, I'll ask a long-term married couple who are seeing me because spice has gone out of their sexual relationship, and I'll ask, how often do you kiss? And almost always they say, oh, we don't kiss anymore. And I love what you say, Joan, on page 35 of your chapter, Reviving Desire. another thing we did, you and Robert, was to get in the mood, was to kiss. Just kiss. And you paid attention to each other's breath. And would you talk a little bit more about that? I know you do in the book, but maybe you could expand even.
Yeah. We loved to kiss. And all kinds of kisses. They could be sweet kisses or passionate kisses. They could be light kisses or tongue kisses. They could be, it didn't even matter. We would start with one and just sometimes just keep our lips attached for what seemed like a really, really long time. And what would happen is we did that, is we would start to get in sync with each other's breathing, as you said. And there was this powerful bonding that took place.
Mm-hmm.
Where we really felt like one person. We felt supremely joined and joyful, and all we were doing was kissing, but it was so intimate. And we would always start our lovemaking that way, just kissing and kissing.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we'd say to each other, one or the other of us would say, let's kiss and kiss.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yes. And then, of course, there have been a number of surveys and research studies that show that, over many years now, that there are many women who'd prefer just a great make-out session with lots of kissing than they even would prefer intercourse.
Well, I think that goes back to what you're saying, though, that once the arousal starts, then the desire will happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because they may think they want one over the other, but maybe if they started with the one, they would want both.
Yes, of course. So kiss, kiss, kiss.
Kiss, kiss, kiss.
Well, clearly we're not going to have time to get to the last part, but we do have time to get to DWO, dating while older.
Okay.
And so let's begin a conversation about that. And that means, for many people, cyber dating, cyber mating. But you say in your book, and it's so true, because, oh, my goodness, I did internet dating for, I suppose 8 years, and I was very fussy after Charlie because he was a tough act to follow, and so I'm very grateful that I found a good man in Brian just about almost 9 months ago. But it was just kissing a lot of frogs. And you say in your book something that I saw too, and that is desperation is easy to spot and a
yes.
major turnoff.
Yes. You can smell it coming.
Yeah.
I mean, you really can. There's some even chemical thing exuding from the skin that you can smell, and it's not appealing.
It's not appealing.
It exudes a kind of neediness. So maybe you're the one and I just need. Do you fit my need? And no, that's not what anybody wants. I want you to know who I am.
Yeah, and you warn people, I think it's in your blog or maybe your book or maybe both, that if a man is just giving you a monologue during the first date and doesn't ask you about yourself, well, there's not going to be a second date.
That's right. Yeah, that's in my blog. I have dating tips for men because I had started to dip my toes in the dating pond and was annoyed by a few things. And I said, well, I'm going to blog about it. Here's what not to do, guys.
Mm-hmm.
One is don't wear sunglasses in your profile picture.
Yeah, that's a very good one. Don't wear sunglasses. You know, the eyes are the window to the soul and
yes,
all that.
Yes, and if you're hiding your eyes, what else are you hiding?
If you're sharing a bedroom.
What did you say, Bill?
And never take your teeth out to brush them the first time you're in the bathroom.
That too. Although I have heard that sometimes somebody who has to wear dentures takes out the teeth and is just amazing with oral sex. But maybe we don't want to go there either.
I think we should celebrate all of it.
And if I may celebrate briefly, I have to say that my dear mother, who has just turned 92 in May, is actually, she's fretting because she hasn't been to a gynecologist for years, and we had a physical, and I'm going to drive her since she gave up driving on her 92nd birthday, as the police in Hawaii say, hallelujah.
Yeah.
But
She is going to her first female gynecologist, who is old enough to be president, but is a child in her mind because she's only 55-year-old. So I have to dash out a little early to take Ms. Evelyn to her first female gynecologist, and she said, "Here, how's this for a spark of life in 92? I always like a male gynecologist." This is KTMI, Honolulu. But anyway, I'll be back next week, so carry on without me. I'll be taking
Ms. Evelyn. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
And give my love to your mother. I love her.
I certainly will.
When you and I were doing radio in Hawaii, she would call in, and she was a riot. She's just... I think he's left. Okay, so he needs to go take his mother
to
the doctor.
I hope Bill will give my book to his mother.
You know what? He should.
Yeah.
Although his father died, apparently his parents had quite the love affair, and I met his father, too, because I think it was only 3 years ago that his father, a retired physician, passed on. And but his mother was so lively and fun and sexual.
Yeah.
And... And, you know, I have to say, my mother, who's 89, is lively and fun and sexual. And her mother, my grandmother, the same. My grandmother was sexual till she was 90. And so I have quite the legacy, and I am grateful for it. And actually, my grandmother, Helen, was the one, because she spoke to me about, you know, no details, but her sexual adventures when I was still in my maybe late 20s, early 30s, and I thought, this is great. It was quite a revolution to me then. This is great. I'm going to focus in, thus my gerontology part, on aging and sexuality.
Wonderful. So that's why you ended up this way, huh?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, the inspiration. Going back to internet dating, I like you have in your book, Yolanda Turner, another business of advice from the expert. Think on a first date. Think of yourself as an interviewer, not the interviewee.
Yes.
And can you, based on your experience, and can you elaborate on that, Joan?
Well, I don't like to see a date exactly like a job interview, but
no.
In a way it is.
Yeah.
Because you're auditioning someone for a second date. You're not auditioning them for the love of your life because you don't know them.
Exactly.
But you are auditioning them for a second date. So you want to be proactive and ask the questions you want to ask.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if someone doesn't ask you the right questions, go ahead and blurt out what's important to you to tell. There are things that I would advise you not to blurt out a whole lot on a first date.
Like about your health?
Like how bad your last boyfriend was.
Oh, that's terrible. Or your last marriage.
Or your last marriage. Or your health. And there's one example in the book, and this is an honest-to-goodness one, from one of my readers who sent in, the worst first date she had had.
Oh, was it Becca?
This was, this was not Becca. This was another person.
Okay.
So Becca had a great saga. But this was someone who had a first date with a man who talked incessantly about his health problems. And he went on and on about this and that and this surgery and what his blood pressure numbers are and his cholesterol numbers. And finally he said, "Oh, I'm doing all the talking. I'm sorry. Let's find out about you. What are your health problems?"
I think that's on your blog.
It is.
Goodness.
Yeah, it is. It
how
is.
Appalling.
I know. But so we need to use a little discretion in what we reveal, how soon. But be yourself. Be totally natural. I don't understand people who say, well, if I don't shave off 10 years and 20 pounds, no one will date me. Well, if that's what it takes for the person, but what do you want with a person who will only date you if you claim to be 10 years and 20 pounds less than you are? I mean, you think they're not going to find out if you meet? And what's the point of that?
Exactly. What's the point? And part of your advice for men about profiles is give your real age and body build.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. And women are going to find out. I had, when I was doing internet dating,
I had a little aversion to a big belly, and some of the guys online, you know, of course, you'd see usually their head and shoulders and not their full body.
Yeah.
Because I associated big bellies with loss and, I don't know, heart disease. And so that, when the guy would appear with a big belly, that was a turnoff because it was also, for me, a sign that he wasn't really taking care of himself.
Yeah.
And I think you relate to that because you consider your fitness, and you are so fit, really
important part of your life.
I
put a lot of time and energy into staying fit. I have bad health problems in my family, and I figure the only thing I can combat it with is my lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important that any man that I spend time with, let alone date, is also cares about his fitness, his health, that he's not overweight, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink to excess. All these things are deal breakers for me just because I give what I'm asking for. I offer what I'm asking for.
Yeah, you give what you're asking for. That's right. Well, because you're authentic, and your Robert was authentic.
Yes.
Real, you know, you're the real deal.
That was his favorite word, by the way, authenticity.
He yes. Yes,
I
love the word, too.
He was playing a musical instrument, authenticity.
Yes. Yes. So I applaud you, Joan, because you told me off-air that you're just beginning to get out and date some, and it takes courage to do that. It took courage for me to do that, and I persevered and stayed optimistic, and I'm glad I did, because while there aren't very many good men out there, there are a few. And if you're authentic and tell your truth, and I think it helps a lot to be still sensual and sexual, because the truth is a lot of guys really do want a sexual woman. They don't want somebody who's... Didn't you have some response to your better than I expected? And one guy said, where are all these sensual women?
Yes, yes. Where are they? I don't meet them, he said.
Yeah.
The ones I meet don't want sex after menopause. I know. And it's also, I have to say, hard in when you're doing online dating. What do you say about that?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know about you, but as sexual as I am, I'm put off by a man who says, and she has to be interested in sex. It's as if, oh, now, is he going to just jump to that right away over coffee?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can we just wait a little to establish that? But on the other hand, I don't know what the protocol is for doing that correctly.
Well, I don't know that there is protocol. I think you have to sort of adjust it for whatever circumstances you're in. I had a client going through the change of life, and she said it's no big deal. And she said some of her friends don't believe her. And, of course, it was her attitude that menopause is not a dramatic change of life, but merely a minor event in a much longer, richer journey. So we're back to attitude.
There was an anthology of personal essays that came out at the time I was going through menopause. It was called Stories from the 14th Moon or something like that.
Mm.
I may have it had 14th Moon in it. And it was different women talking about their experience going through menopause.
Uh-huh.
And the shortest one of all said, I didn't really notice menopause because I was in love at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was certainly true for me.
Yeah.
When I went through it and was married to Charlie, I feel like I just sailed through it. I hardly even had a hot flash. So, I mean, some of that is genetics, perhaps. But I think a lot of it's attitude and...
I was teaching aerobics with a water bottle filled with ice stuck into my leotard between my breasts.
So and maybe you weren't quite sailing through it.
Yeah, I was aerobic dancing through it, but I'll tell you, I did feel it. But I literally would just fill this water bottle with ice
and stick it between my breasts so that the top of the bottle emerged over the top of my leotard. This, you could tell how old I am from even leotard. And that's how I handled it, with ice between my breasts.
Wow. Anyway, different temperatures can provide. And even in a sexual relationship, either hot or cold can be kind of sensual. But going back to, and of course we've got, maybe 5 minutes, but going back to dating on the internet, you write on your blog, I love it when men 50 plus are looking for women their age or even maybe a little older.
Yeah.
But some of you say that you're seeking to date women who are at least 10 years your junior. And I think you wisely ask, is that simply an attraction thing, or are you ruling out vibrant women your age for some reason?
Mm-hmm.
And when you've asked that question in your, I guess, on your internet stuff, you often don't get an answer, you said.
I often don't get an answer at all. I mean, if I'm reading someone's profile and he looks very appealing and he's my age, and then I get to the end where what he's looking for is a woman 10 years younger or 15 years younger, then I'll often just dash off that note. You know, I really was enjoying your profile till I got to this.
So,
and then I'll ask that question as you quoted me. And usually I don't ever hear from him. Once in a while, though, and this makes it all worth it, someone says, I probably shouldn't have said that because I don't really feel that way. Thanks.
Yeah. So it's a sort of a cultural thing that may kick in for some men. And I really like the advice for men when we meet. Be yourself. Be truthful. Tell me about yourself, and I'll do the same. And we've already touched on that a little bit because we want to avoid dumping matters of health and past relationships. And then you talk a little bit about who assumes the financial part of the date. And who's going to pick up the check? Say a little more about that, Joan.
Well, I personally always assume we'll split the check. And so I always pull out my wallet. Usually it's just a coffee date to start. But if we're having a nice talk, maybe we'll decide to continue it over dinner. And then I'll always pull out my wallet and say, I'm assuming I'm paying my share, or I'm assuming we're splitting it. And he'll often look at me like, oh, that's great. And occasionally he'll say, oh, no, I insist, I want to pay. And so I'm not going to fight with him about it. There's nothing at stake for me.
Right.
I'm just letting him know, of course, I'm assuming this. But if he's saying, no, I really want to pay, I had a great time with you, or then thank you very much. I sure don't like it if he assumes I'll pay.
Which
doesn't happen except that. And I was writing on to another writer who is interviewing me for a story, and she said, what about younger men who want to date older women? Do you have any do's and don'ts for them? And I had a number of them, but one of them was, don't expect that we'll pay just because we're older. We don't want to be seen as money bags.
Right, right. And in your book, you also quote, let me see if I can find that. It's in your blog. It's your straight single Single Sexy and Dating by Catherine Ann Forsyth. And she says, keep your sense of humor, have fun. And then she says, remember that there are three legs of the stool, and they all count. All are needed for a solid relationship: financial, psychological, physical. Score high on each and you have a winner. And I like that advice. And move on if it doesn't feel right. We're going to have to move on because we've come out.
Oh, no.
We've reached the end of the hour. But thank you, Joan Price. And people, don't forget to go to her website. But we have her website, nakedatourage.com.
That's the blog, but that works.
And the blog. And we have you back on the 22nd.
JoanPrice.com.
And JoanPrice.com. And you'll want to get her book. And Just remember, everybody, thank you, Joan Price.
Thank you.
We are all on our necessary journeys, aren't we, Joan? Our necessary journeys. So next week, I have a similar but it'll be different interview with Joan Moran, another Joan, who's written a memoir called Sex, 60, and Tango.
Ooh.
Yeah, and she teaches tango, and, yeah, another dancer who's over 60. But hers is a little different. So, anyway, Joan, you'll be back on the 22nd. Thank you again for being the guest today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Me too. So much, Joan. You're terrific. And I wish you well, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Happy feet, da-da-da, happy feet.